This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from the team at Lad Bible who bring you Minutes With. If you've ever watched an episode, you'll know the type of stories you can expect from us. Gangsters.
The police has come round with guns. No, they're right, now we're f***.
Hackers.
We hacked the Prime Minister of Tunisia.
Spies.
The whole of the area where we were was infested with Stasi vehicles.
And people who've been through unique experiences.
You know, one thing you should know about espionage, as well as bomb making, the first mistake is your last mistake.
In this new series, we get stuck into a more in-depth conversation with some extraordinary people who've led extraordinary lives.
I don't mind talking about it because I'm not ashamed. And I didn't realise that anyone would find out or know, or anyone would judge me for it.
I'm Ben Powell-Jones, and in this episode, we sit down with Eamon Dean. Eamon's a really unassuming guy. Looking at him, you'd maybe guess he worked in the city, or he was a maths teacher at a school, not a former Al-Qaeda terrorist who then spied against them for the West. Eamon started out working as a bomb maker for Al-Qaeda in the late 90s.
He sent me to a specialist camp which was developing not only cutting-edge new explosive bombing materials, but also chemical weapons and biological weapons.
Then something happened, and Eamon had a change of heart. He tried to leave Al-Qaeda, but was recruited by British intelligence services, MI5 and MI6.
And there in Heathrow, I had two people coming to meet me, one from MI5 and one from MI6. Both are from counterterrorism.
After months of training, he was sent back to Afghanistan, but now is a spy. Eamon was at the heart of the world's most dangerous terrorist organisation through attacks like 9/11 and the London bombings. We hear about how close he came to being exposed, what information he was able to pass back, and what it was like living alongside Osama bin Laden, the most infamous criminal of the century. And we also hear whether it's affected him, because from the outside, it doesn't seem to have. This is Eamon's story.
We've met before, obviously, Eamon, but for anyone who's listening or watching for the first time, could you just introduce yourself? Tell me who you are.
Okay, well, my name is Eamon Dean. Born in Saudi Arabia, Bahraini origin. Grew up in Saudi Arabia as a nerd, someone who loved books and, you know, reading. And I was actually training to become an imam. I wanted to become an imam from a young age. However, life always got different plans, and I ended up, you know, joining the jihad when I was 16 in Bosnia in 1994. After that, I never looked back. I ended up going from one place to another and ended up in the lap of the British intelligence services 4 years later in 1998. After that, I worked for them as a spy for 8 years, up until 2006. After 2006, unfortunately, I was outed by a US journalist and my cover was blown, unfortunately. And so I ended up working in a bank.
I mean, what's amazing there, Eamon, is you've given a sort of a very concise 40-second introduction to yourself, and I feel like you've described about 12 lives and three James Bond films in that. So what we'll do now is we'll get back all the way to the beginning and we'll go through that in a little bit more detail. Thank you for joining us again, and I'm really excited to talk to you about your life. So you describe growing up as a nerd in Saudi Arabia. What does that mean, growing up as a nerd in Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi society in the 1980s was a society where young people were more concerned, you know, with either the cars and the new models of cars or with sports, especially football. So I was never interested in cars or in sports or in football. So for me, it was my pastime was reading books, especially on history, on geography. I'm someone who's fascinated by maps. I'm fascinated by countries, their capitals, their populations. And, you know, if you come and ask me at the age of 9, I could recite the capitals of the world, the populations, you know, and that was usually odd. And I think in later life, maybe much later than I thought, realized that maybe that was a form of autism. I don't know. But nonetheless, when I was young, I was more busy, you know, reading than participating in what was the norm, what was accepted from young boys at that time, what was expected, I would say.
And was that, can I take from that that you were someone that was quite a loner? Did you have a big group of friends who were into similar interests, or were you somebody that kind of stayed away on their own, locked in their room, poring over maps?
The irony is, I wasn't a loner. Because the fact that the religious establishments there in Saudi Arabia were far more inclusive than what would one would give them credit for. Mm. So for someone like me, I would basically end up joining an Islamic awareness circle in the local mosque. That is where I found my friends. I mean, in the school, I would have two or three friends who were closer and have the similar mindset out of a class of 33. Mm-hmm. But in the Islamic awareness circle where I used to go, almost all the 40, 50 people who were there, most of them my age or slightly older, were all of them friends. Mm. And I think, you know, the fact that I was surrounded by like-minded people was a blessing.
Mm. And you said a minute ago that your initial intention had been to become an imam. So obviously that's a word that is familiar these days in popular culture. But for anyone who might not know what it means, what is an imam and why did you want to become one?
Well, an imam is someone who leads the prayers in the mosque. You know, he would sometime act as a counselor for, you know, the local people. He leads the congregation in prayers, in funerals, and someone who more or less like the local person for adjudicating disputes and helping people deal with their daily problems. I thought this is a noble profession, and I want to really become one. And I made the start by age 9. By age 12, I started to delve deeper into Islamic theology. But the age 12 was far more important for me on a personal reason, because my mother passed away when I was 12. So that pushed me further and further towards understanding theology.
Well, that's quite deep kind of thought processes and concepts for a 12-year-old. At this point, would you say you were a deeply religious child, or would you say at this point it was almost more educational and cultural?
Was I a religious child? Oh, yes. There is no question about it. I was. And I was deeply religious, I think, because of the fact that my father passed away at the age of 4, and the fact that I was supposed to be with him in the car. He died in a car collision. And so, and if it wasn't for a shard of glass that I stepped on in the kitchen before he was, you know, supposed to leave the house, and therefore I was supposed to fix my feet instead of going with him. If I went with him, I would have died with him.
Wow.
So, you know, so the question of fate was always there, because I was always asking my mom, I would say, you know, what is fate and how do we understand fate? And she would say that fate sometime can come in the form of something minor, a minor irritation that stops you from meeting a unpleasant end. So sometime what you believe to be a minor irritation could actually be your life savior.
Mm.
So I've learned from that there is a complicated plan in action, and whoever put that complicated plan in place knows about where my life will end, whether it is a year from now or 70 years from now.
Mm.
So therefore, I should be on the good side of whoever put this plan rather than on the bad side of whoever put that plan. So that is, I think, why from young age I understood, that fate is what control our lives. And therefore, I need to understand, who put this plan together for me and for everyone else.
There's quite a lot there that I'd like to get into a little bit deeper maybe later on as we go through your story. But I'd like to go back now to your life as it played out. So you're 12 years old. You're now moving into theology of religion. How did that end up becoming somebody who moved into what would later be described as a terrorist?
Well, no one, as I said many times before, no one wakes up one day and say that I want to become a terrorist. Mm. I mean, it doesn't happen like that. You are seduced into it. There is a long process of seduction. and being lured into it. And, you know, that saying, which is, you know, been said many times, but in my case, it's really true. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. And goodness, I've seen this not only with me personally, but with so many people around me. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I've learned a long time ago that good intentions are not enough. Without wisdom, this path will lead you to hell, unfortunately. So how it happened? I was born in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia and grew up there. You know, it has a sectarian divide, Shias and Sunnis. And not far away from us in the 1980s, you know, the Iran-Iraq war was raging. And it was actually between a, you know, Sunni power, Iraq, and a Shia power, Iran. And in our schools, actually, there was always this taunting between the two sides, even though we were young. But the Sunnis supported Saddam, you know, the Shia supported Khomeini and Iran, even though we were only 11 and 12 year olds. And yet we were taunting each other about, you know, who's winning and who's losing, as if it is, you know, to do with, you know, football match, mm-hmm. rather than like, you know, an actual war raging around. My mother come from Lebanon. So throughout the 80s, she was worried about her family back home, who were going through a vicious civil war that was ethnic, sectarian, and religious. And at the same time, when I was 11, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And refugees were coming, you know, from Kuwait into our town. And then 500,000 foreign troops, including, you know, many Americans, you know, came in order to defend Saudi Arabia against Saddam Hussein and then to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. I've mentioned to you now, you know, three major conflicts happening around me, and I'm experiencing them. Mm-hmm. It is enough to politicize any child, let alone, like, you know, I mean, someone who was already into geography, history, and politics. So for me, the experience, you know, I lived in the 1980s, coupled with the fact that I was deeper into theology, prepared me somehow for, you know, accepting the fact that human conflict is actually an integral part, you know, of, you know, being a human on this planet, that there will always be a push and pull between people based on many motives, whether they are territorial, religious, you know, economic. One way or another, it's our destiny to fight each other.
Am I right in thinking that the first part of your life that saw you fighting was when you were 16 in Bosnia? Is that correct?
Yes.
Could you tell us how you got there?
Well, when the Bosnian conflict started in 1992, I was watching closely the idea that there are Muslims who are, you know, Europeans, you know, for all intents and purposes. After all, that, you know, they are Slavic, you know, mm-hmm. People who just converted to Islam in, you know, in the 16th century, and yet they are slaughtered in mass just because of their names, even though in appearance and even in DNA they are, you know, absolute copy of the Serbs, and yet they were being killed for their religious identity. For me, it was shocking. And also at the same time, the fact that one of my teachers in school, a math teacher who come from an affluent family, went there and fought there and died there.
Right.
So the fact that the Bosnian conflict, even though it was raging, you know, 3,000 miles away, it was ever so present in my own classroom because a teacher, you know, his chair is empty now because he thought that it didn't matter that he is from Saudi Arabia, the solidarity, that religious solidarity with the fellow Muslims in Bosnia was far more important, and therefore he went there and he died there for them. And for me, I thought, if he could do that, why couldn't I? Mm. It's just the trigger wasn't there. All it needed for me to go was a trigger, and a trigger came actually in September of 1994, when a friend of mine from the same circle, from the Islamic Awareness Circle, who was 3 years my senior, was about to leave to Bosnia. I was going to his home to say, you know, goodbye. But in the 10 minutes I was actually walking to his home, I formed my opinion, I formed my mind, I finally made my mind, and I said to him, I'm going to go with you. And I remember he was saying, well, look, I'm a 19-year-old. Actually, I had a 2 months training in Afghanistan in a summer, you know, 2 summers ago. So, however, why do you think the jihad needs you? You know, you are a nerd, you know, and I can't even, you know, imagine you, you know, carrying an AK-47. I mean, so he said, do you really think the jihad needs you? And I said to him, no, I need it. And I remember that answer changed his mind and changed my life. I mean, he decided, maybe you're right. Maybe, you know, you have the right mindset for it, that you're not going there because you think it's a picnic or a, you know, an adventure.
Mm.
No, actually, you have the right mindset to it. You said you need it. It means that, you know, for you, you see the jihad as a cleansing and a journey of discovery.
I see. Interesting. And, you know, what stands out to me is that you were 16. Obviously, your life has been exceptionally different to mine in the, in, you know, lead up to being 16. But if I had made a decision similar to that in my life, even to join the military at 16, I would have had a group of people around me who probably would have tried to talk me out of it until I was a little bit older or, you know, classed as an adult or something like that. The group of people around you at that point in your life, if you said, I'm going to go and join the jihad, would they have been trying to talk you out of it? Or was it something people would be proud of and saying, you know, you've made a really courageous decision? Like, I'm just trying to get my head around how a 16-year-old makes such an incredible decision and the people around that person either allow it or trying to talk you out of it? Or what was the process after that?
Well, I mean, if I was going to tell everyone around me, you know, about my decision to go to the jihad in Bosnia, I mean, you know, I would say 95% would have tried to talk me out of it. Mm. I can tell you that. In fact, if I told my 5 older siblings that I'm going to the jihad in Bosnia, I mean, first of all, they will lock me up in the room and right. They will confiscate my passport, and that's it. That's the right. End of it. So the whole process was secretive.
Wow. Wow. So you didn't tell your siblings, you didn't tell any extended family.
No.
You made a plan, and from the point you decided to do it to the point that you were getting on a plane, how long was that?
Well, I would say about 2 weeks.
My God.
Yeah.
And you went with your friend?
Absolutely. And 2 other friends who joined us from Riyadh, from the capital of Saudi Arabia. So we were 4. And yeah, by October of 1994, we landed in Bosnia.
Were you scared?
No. Ironically, no, I was excited.
And at that point, is that overwriting any relationships you might have with other humans? So, for example, you've talked about your siblings. You know, did you feel sadness at the thought you might never see them again? Or did you think when they found out what you'd done, they'd be happy and they'd be proud of you? Or what was that kind of feeling like?
When I was at the border, that's it. Like, you know, I'm 45 minutes, you know, drive from the Bosnian border. I was in Croatia at that time near Dubrovnik. And I, you know, decided, okay, now after 5 days disappearance and my family has no idea where I've gone, so I'm going to, you know, give my home a call, and I see whoever picks up, I will tell them where I'm going. So I phoned home, and my older brother picked up, and he was frantic. He was saying, we were looking for you everywhere for 2 days. You know, you told us you're going for a camping trip in the desert for the weekend, and you will be back. And when you were not back, like, you know, we were really worried. And when we called the police said that you've left. You left the country. And you're going to Vienna. Where are you going exactly? I said, well, currently I'm in Croatia. So, of course, they are not idiots. I mean, my brothers are all university graduates and, you know, worldly people. They traveled. So when he heard Croatia, he heard it on the news so many times, and he said, you know, are you going to Bosnia? You know, and I said, yes. And then there was a moment of silence. And then he said, are you going to fight there? So I decided, like, you know, I don't know what came over my mind. Like, you know, I wanted to just joke with him. I said, no, I'm going there to harvest onions. What do you expect me to do? Like, you know, I mean, of course I'm going to fight, you idiot. And so, you know, he laughed nervously. But then he said, is there anything I could say or do that will make you change your mind and come back? Anything. Just ask for anything. You know, all of us, like, you know, whatever you ask for, we will give it to you. Just come back. And I said to him, nothing. Seriously, like, you know, I'm only 45 minutes from the border. Nothing will change my mind. So after a while being silent, he just said to me, God be with you. And he hung the phone. And that's it.
So for anyone watching or listening that might not understand, can you explain briefly what the Bosnian conflict was and who you were fighting for and who you were fighting against?
Well, as you know, in the early 1990s, Yugoslavia, you know, a country that no longer exists, you know, it broke up. I mean, so it was a union between six countries. You know, so you have Montenegro, you have Serbia, you have Croatia, Bosnia, Slovenia, and Macedonia, which is now known as North Macedonia. So these countries were part of a union, but then it started to break up. As the Soviet Union broke up, also Yugoslavia broke up. And first it was a war between Croatia and Serbia, and then it turned into then later a conflict within Bosnia. When the war ended in Bosnia, you know, 14 December of 1995, by that time I was 17-year-old. Mm. And for me, the sadness I felt is not that we buried two friends, actually so many friends died. You know, we were the volunteer unit of the Mujahideen Brigade in Bosnia at that time used to be about 1,000. You know, we buried 300. You know, there in Bosnia, more than that. And so I remember that when I was leaving, it wasn't so much the sadness that, you know, that the war is over. The sadness is that I survived the war.
Wow.
That is the mindset at that time. And I remind the listener, that was my mindset at that time. Mm. So I felt a sense of failure that the mission was to die there, was that a well-aimed bullet, a well-aimed shell should find me, but it never found me. And for whatever reason, I survived that war, while others won the honor of being martyrs. So, you know, so when I was boarding that plane from Split in Croatia to Rome and from there to Istanbul, I felt a sense of failure that, you know, I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve. I would say, like, you know, my first jihad experience ended and I'm still alive. So I have to hop now into the next jihad experience. So I thought, okay, where should I go next? And I remember that in the last days of the Bosnian conflict, I met an Al-Qaeda militant who came to Bosnia to look for recruits. And when I met him, he gave me a phone number and he said, don't go to the Caucasus. It's a waste of time. Go to Afghanistan. The camps are reopening. And there is a new kind of war that you need to be prepared for. Go and learn other military skills, useful skills. So that man, his name is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who would later become the mastermind of 9/11. He gave me that phone number and he said, call that phone number. There will be a man called Abu Zubaydah. Now he is a famous inmate in Guantanamo. That man, just tell him, I sent you, and he will take care of you. He will send you to the right military camp for you in Afghanistan. So I called him in May of 1996, and I said to him, I would love to come. And he said, yes, no problem at all. You know, he fixed a date with me. I came into Peshawar airport, and then I was transported 2 days later into Afghanistan. 3 months later, after I spent my time training there, Osama bin Laden arrived from Sudan, running for his life, you know, into Afghanistan, and started just the embryonic stages of establishing Al-Qaeda. So in August of 1996, myself and 13 others, you know, who were mostly from Saudi Arabia and from other Gulf Arab countries, we went to see him.
This is bin Laden?
Yes, this is bin Laden. So, and goodness, the first time I saw him, I was like, is this the famous bin Laden? Because he really looked disheveled. He wasn't well-dressed, not the same image that you see always of someone who's well-dressed in nice robes and, you know, and a turban with no crease in it. No, 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 he was really disheveled. And all of the people around him in that little compound, they looked really as if they are refugees.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Boxes everywhere, you know, suitcases everywhere. It looked a very disorganized place. But nonetheless, the way he spoke to us was confident. And he spoke to us about what I call Islamic eschatology. You know, he's talking about the prophecies and how he believed that his flight from Sudan to Afghanistan is the beginning of something big. And that there is a prophecy about it. This is the land where the Muslim armies will rise and will start their march towards the Middle East to liberate Arabia, to liberate Jerusalem, and to liberate Baghdad and Damascus and Cairo and Sana'a and Yemen. All of these places will be liberated because of the army we're building here. And, you know, of course, like, you know, for me, I was looking at him and I was thinking, an army? You're just a bunch of refugees. You just arrived. I mean, you know, how will you build an army out of this that is capable of doing all of what you are trying to achieve? And Bin Laden might have looked disheveled at the time, but actually he gave the impression of being able to read your mind.
It's incredible to sit here with you. It's incredible to sit here with you and think that you're someone who's met Bin Laden, you know, who's arguably one of the most, in my lifetime, has altered the course of the world and world history, one of the most iconic figures. And it's also interesting to hear what you say about meeting him for the first time and him seeming kind of like a bit disheveled. But he was obviously a very good speaker because he could change your mind based on, you know, your initial thoughts of him seeming a little bit unimpressive. Was he somebody at that point in time? Because obviously, pre-9/11, I don't think the West would have ever heard his name. But you said 5 years before that, 5 years and 1 month before that, you were aware of him already. So was he somebody that was, did he have a big reputation at that point in that world already?
Within the jihadist circles, yes. He was a legend already, you know, since his exploits in the Afghan jihad conflict against the Soviets in 1987, what happened in the famous Battle of Jaji against the Soviet commandos, 1989, and the withdrawal of the Soviet forces, the 1992 fall of Kabul and the fall of the communist government there. All of these events, you know, always Bin Laden was in the background. And so when he left to Sudan in 1992, people were always, you know, viewing him within the jihadist circles as a legend, as a veteran, as a hero of that conflict.
And what could he do? Was it that he was a great leader? Was it he was a mastermind? Was it strategy? Was it brave? You know, what was the thing that people thought about him?
He wasn't just an administrator and a competent one at that. Mm. He was also a brave man who would actually go and fight alongside his subordinates.
Mm. Was it just the first time that you met him, or did you meet him again subsequently?
No, I met him a few times after that, but most importantly, it was in September of 1997 when I gave him my oath of allegiance. So that is when I joined Al-Qaeda proper, and they decided that, well, I remember his words to me, you don't look the commando's material, you know, you're not going to be end up in our special
force. He said that to you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but I know of a better use for you. You know, and so he sent me to a specialist camp, which was developing not only cutting-edge new explosive, and bombing materials, but also chemical weapons and biological weapons.
And this is where you started to fulfill your main role in Al-Qaeda, which was as a bomb maker.
Well, I was a trainee bomb maker. Let's put it this way. You know, the good thing is that I never built a device outside of a training setting. So, because, you see, within 11 months, I changed my mind. Mm. So, luckily, and it's because of that inevitability, you see, 11 months into my training, you know, as a bomb maker and, you know, into, you know, making poisons and chemical weapons and biological weapons, and all of this, you know, especially the biological program was extremely rudimentary, but their chemical weapons was far, you know, more sophisticated than I expected, but their explosives making was a cutting edge at that time. You know, they were pushing the envelope, you know, when it comes to, you know, maximizing, you know, what they call the, you know, the explosive yield, you know, of ordinary materials. You know, that was brilliant. But at the 11th month, in August of 1998, there was an event which basically, you know, shook my consciousness all the way down to the core. I mean, I thought that, no, I can't be part of this anymore, which was the East Africa bombings, you know, in 1998, you know, two American embassies, Dar es Salaam in Tanzania and Nairobi in Kenya. The American embassies there were targeted, but in particular, what horrified me was the attack in Nairobi itself. It was a massive bomb, almost 750 kg of high explosives, and it was loaded with shrapnels. So many shrapnels, thousands of them. And it was designed to maximize casualties. Mm. 220 people died. 12 Americans killed. And the rest were innocent Kenyans, Somalis, Ugandans, who were there at the wrong place at the wrong time. And in addition, 5,000 people were wounded. 150 of them were blinded for life because of the amount of shrapnels embedded. And I remember prior to the attacks, we tested the 1.3 tons device there in our camp. And so, you know, I was aware that they were training us for massive mega bombs. And I was thinking, you know, 3, 4, 5 days after the attacks and as the information were still coming and filtering through and all the, all the images were coming through, I remember I was asking myself, one day they will deploy me, you know, and I will be in another capital, another city, another location, building a device like this. Now, because of the religious education I had, which is, by the way, much more than the average Al-Qaeda member would have. So my exposure to theology is far greater than an average Al-Qaeda or average jihadist, you know, recruit. So that was a blessing in a sense, because I was asking myself, since I believe in the afterlife because of all the death that was around me, like, I mean, my father dying, my mother dying, you know, and so for me, I was asking myself, one day I will stand before God and he will, you know, ask me the question, all of these people, and I will be seeing their faces in the afterlife, why did you kill them? Mm. What was the reason? And so for me, I remember I went to ask the Mufti of Al-Qaeda at that time, the dean of the Sharia College, you know, of Al-Qaeda. Yes, they had a Sharia College there in Afghanistan. And so I went to ask him. I said to him, and he's Egyptian, I said to him, you know, I'm not doubting anything, but just can you put my heart at peace here? How can we justify killing that huge number of people? You know, we're talking about, like, you know, hundreds of people who had nothing to do whatsoever, you know, in the conflict between us and the Americans, not to mention the 5,000 people who were wounded. And so he said that, oh, we have a religious justification. We have what we call the Tatarrus fatwa. What is that? He said the human shield fatwa. If the enemy is hiding behind civilians, then we are allowed, you know, to do that. We have the permission. We have the religious license and the theological license to do that. So I remember when I heard this, I said, can you tell me where I can find it? And luckily, he told me where to find it. It is in the comprehensive works of Ibn Taymiyyah, you know, a 13th century Islamic scholar. But the problem is it's 37 volumes. Thank God I was able to find it in the volume 28 2 weeks later.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I'm annoyingly inquisitive.
Of course.
At that time and still to this day. So so I went and I, opened, the book and I started reading the fatwa. And actually what I read there, was shocking. That fatwa, that religious edict, actually relates to the Mongol invasions of the Muslim lands in Central Asia. In the 11th century, sorry, in the 13th century, in the early 13th century, in the 1200s, the Mongols, had a practice at the time, which is if they sack one city, they take civilians as prisoners from one city, and then they make them go in front of their armies to push the siege towers towards the walls of the city they want to sack next. Mm-hmm. So they were asking, are we allowed to kill our fellow Muslims who are prisoners, and they are coerced into pushing the enemy siege towers towards our walls? Are we allowed to do that? And the answer was yes, because they are dead anyway. So do not add yourself to the list of the dead. Now, how could this be applied to what happened in Nairobi and what happened in Tanzania? How can I say that the American embassy in Nairobi was pushing siege towers towards Mecca and Medina, that there was a life and death situation that needed to be dealt with right there, right now? I mean, it was shocking for me that, you know, that my fellow Al-Qaeda members would violate, you know, religion this way, to the point, not only to a breaking point, but they have broken it already.
Was it in reading that that you felt what was happening was the Mufti was purposefully misinterpreting the text to suit what he wanted to do?
No, there was no misinterpretation. Actually, it was a twisting. You know, it was a complete violation of this. And I, for me, I felt, no, I can't be part of this. Because, you see, for the average jihadist, you know, they could waive that question for later because they say ignorance is bliss. Mm. Yeah, it is, truly, like for most of them. First, they are ignorant of their own faith. I wasn't. And they are not, you know, trainee bomb makers. I was. And therefore, the weight, you know, of this question on my mind was so great that one day I will be building one of these bombs and one day I will be responsible for a wholesale of death of people who don't deserve it. And I didn't like the direction. You know, I thought that I was being trained as a bomb maker in order to build IEDs against tanks, against, you know, armored vehicles, not against civilian population. That's not what I signed up for. And so I decided to leave.
But the bit that's interesting to me there is you had signed up as a bomb maker and you were comfortable that that would be your role. But was it more that you thought that the people that would be affected by your bombs were people who deserved it?
Yeah, I thought like, and we will be fighting against the military. Until then, we were told we're going to fight the American military in the Middle East. However, this is why I always say that the moment, the first atrocity that Al-Qaeda committed was the East Africa bombings. And it was the first, you know, bombings they carried out against the Americans. And I was totally against it from the beginning. Mm. Because I thought we will be fighting against American military. I will be preparing my bombs for to attack American bases, American tanks, American, American armored vehicles, not against, you know, embassies or civilians or hotels or any kind of civilian target like this. I decided, no, this is not for me. My friends were going somewhere where I can't follow anymore.
Mm, it's interesting because I suppose all the way back at the beginning of your journey when you were 16, what you went to do was, I suppose, protect people who you felt were being innocently executed for the religion, and had it kind of flipped round to the point where now you were designing bombs which were going to effectively kill people who had nothing to do with it.
Absolutely, because I was told we're going to fight the military. Mm. But then the first act was to go and kill civilians in a wholesale attack. Mm. I thought that that's it. I can't be part of this. Mm. And so I started plotting my exit.
So just to go back a little bit, because I know it was something that we made a video before and something people were really quite interested in, I think, was the logistics of being a bomb maker in Al-Qaeda. Like you said there, it was cutting edge. The way it's represented in kind of Hollywood films and things like that is kind of, you know, benches with bits of explosive all over and shaky hands, and if something goes wrong, the whole area gets exploded by accident. Is that accurate, or is it much more like a kind of factory precision?
If a British or an American, you know, a safety expert were to enter into our lab and to see us working with chemicals in that manner, they would have a heart attack.
Right. You know,
they would say, the, you know, the level of safety regulations here are so lacking. I mean, there is none, actually. No, I mean, it was just jars and jars of chemicals, you know, and powders and stuff like that. Like, you know, I mean, and, you know, we are just working with rudimentary, you know, equipments. And it was designed like that because we are supposed to build bombs, you know, at the most basic level. Mm. So we, you know, we have to be trained with the most basic of equipments, the most basic, safety standards in order to be ready to do this at any environment. And so, yeah, I mean, it looks as if we are in a very primitive kitchen mixing, you know, spices, but in fact, it is not.
Were there ever any disasters? You know, did people blow themselves up or poison themselves because of the lack of safety restrictions?
Well, Generally, no, because I remember, you know, from the first day we go into this course, first of all, at each course, which could last months and months and months, there are only four or five people maximum, you know, four people to five people getting the training. So the lesser the number, the lesser the potential for disaster. That's the first thing. Second thing is that the people are selected, you know, for their, you know, skills, for their wisdom, for their lack of being rash. Yeah. Because the worst thing, you know, you could do is to be in a hurry when you are dealing with these chemicals. And we were always told that treat the 100th device, you know, you are building as if it was your first. Mm-hmm. You know, never get too confident, you know, because, you know, these are angry chemicals, you know, mm-hmm. and they could basically explode in your face. Your first mistake is your last mistake. You will never live, you know, to tell the tale about the mistake like, you know, you make. And so this is why, you know, we were always careful. However, disasters do happen between now and then. And in fact, there was one disaster in late 1999 where two people were killed. Because of the fact that they were doing it the wrong way. It's not just only about what chemicals you mix, also the temperatures, because sometimes when you are dealing with chemicals and you have a reaction, and especially when you are adding, let's say, sulfuric acid with acetone and these things, and, you know, you are actually raising the temperature. Mm-hmm. You know, the temperature is rising and you hear the sounds of, you know, little explosions coming, like, you know, I mean, and the smoke. And you always have a bucket of cold water next to you to pour over the mix just in case it's about to explode. And you are already wearing wet clothes and you use the Arabic headscarf, it's so wet, and you are wrapping it around, right, you know, your face. These are the rudimentary, safety measures that we take. But we are absolutely dealing with things that could go wrong at any moment. But they put us in this situations in order to test our nerves and to make sure that actually when we are building in other locations, we will have more comfortable, mm-hmm. you know, settings. Because it's Afghanistan, after all. I mean, basically, you know, if I'm doing it in Barcelona, if I'm doing it, let's say, in London, if I'm doing it in Prague, I mean, I will be in a better, you know, facility. Mm-hmm. I will have better equipments. I will have better chemicals and better safety environment. So, you know, always remember, no matter how much, you know, better the environment, just don't make that lull you into a false sense of security.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm based on what you say there about the safety restrictions being low. It's amazing to think that what you had as a kind of safety measure was a bucket of cold water when you're making a bomb. It seems quite minimal. But then, okay, so now you've decided to leave. You've made a decision that actually something's triggered in you and your morals have been tested. You're not happy. And in some ways, it mirrors the first time when you were 16. You have to make a secret mission to go somewhere that people don't want you to go to, right?
Yeah. And I remember I was, you know, thinking about it. It was September of 1998. I just, 2 weeks ago, I survived a cruise missile attack by the Americans because they were retaliating, you know, for what happened in Nairobi and Tanzania. And so I was feeling that again, you know, there is a divine plan here, divine providence that saved me from, an inevitable death. So I decided that I have to think of something that is credible. And so in November the previous year, in 1997, I was struck by both typhoid and malaria. Mm. And that actually almost killed me. And so I was sent to Qatar for treatment there. And I remember the hospital told me that there was a problem with your liver. And so we need to check, and while we took care of it, we need to check in a year time. You have to come back, so we do the scans and to make sure all is fine and mm-hmm. there is no danger. So, so I thought, okay, I will inform, you know, the leadership that I might have to go to Qatar again for that medical checkup because I was told to come back in a year time, and that would be late November. Mm. So everyone agreed to it. It seems normal. And yes, you can go. I mean, you know, that's fine. Just make sure you check in with our friends there and, you know, our associates. And so, and this is how I just landed in Qatar in November of 1998. And my thinking was, that's it, I'm not coming back. I remember when I was taking the flight from Peshawar Airport all the way to Doha, I was renouncing my oath of allegiance. You know, I was in the airplane sitting in the in my seat, and I was renouncing the oath of allegiance and just leaving this life behind me. And I was thinking, that's it, you know, I will not see Afghanistan anymore. I was actually looking at, you know, when we were flying, and I was looking at, you know, the mountains of the Khyber Pass. You know, I can see the, you know, the mountains of Afghanistan, you know, from the airplane. And I was thinking, that's it, goodbye and good riddance. I didn't know that I would be coming back again, and pretty much soon.
Yeah, and that's a bit of your story that's really unusual. So what happens then? So you fly out, you think, that's it, I'm gone for good. Mm-hmm. How do you end up getting sent back?
So what happened is that I landed in Doha, in Qatar, and I stayed with a friend for a whole night. And then the next day, I was telling him about my plans and that I want to leave. But then, of course, a phone call comes from the Qatari intelligence services, you know, telling my friend that, you know, the friend that you have, bring him to our building, you know, and we don't want any trouble. Just, you know... just tell him he will be well treated. And so I was dropped there. I told him, it's okay, do it. Like, you know,
scared?
I wasn't, you know. Again, like, you know, because, you know, when they say, because they are Bedouins, and, you know, I grew up with Bedouins all my life in Saudi Arabia. So when they say, reassure him that he will not be well, he will be well treated, so they mean it. Okay. So I wasn't, and they kept their, you know, promise. Like, and I mean, they really treated me well. They brought me in for questioning, and I noticed that there were so many of them. It's like I'm sitting in one chair, and in front of me there is a table, big long table, and on the other side, you know, there are 9-10 of them. Like, I mean, it's like, hey, I'm being outnumbered here. And then they told me, look, you know, to make this easy on you, I don't know, we know who you are. We know about your associations with many people like Abu Zubaydah and others, and we know, like, in which camps he went to, and, you know, that you're a member of Al-Qaeda. We know a lot about you. And we were warned of your coming here. And then I realized from their line of questioning that they really knew a lot. And that, you know, and I somehow guessed the reason for that is my association with Abu Zubaydah, the current Guantanamo Bay inmate. And the one who was the gatekeeper, you know, for many jihadist organizations, including Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. So they said to me, look, it will make it easier on you and on us if you just tell us the truth. You know, so we know everything. Do you deny that you're a member of Al-Qaeda? And now I said, no, I don't deny anything. I mean, everything you said is accurate. And this is, I think, where they were taken aback. And they were looking at each other like they were expecting, you know, this, you know, legendary Al-Qaeda resistance, you know, to questioning and the hostility, and I'm not going to talk and you can do your worst, this kind of thing. And instead, basically me, you know, sitting there smiling at them and telling them, yeah, it's accurate. So you don't deny anything? Oh, no. Okay. That's really, like, you know, we expected 45 minutes of, you know, back and forth, but, you know, okay. And, you know, why a young, fine man like you being a member of Al-Qaeda?
So how old are you at this point?
I was 20 at that time. So the, you know, the main officer, the one who was questioning me, was asking, is there something we're missing here? You seem to be comfortable. And then... you know, because you're telling us, you know, and you're incriminating yourself, you're telling us that, yes, you were trained there and that, you know, you have these associations and you seem to be comfortable telling us all about it. Is there something we're missing? And I said, actually, on the way back, I renounced my oath of allegiance. I was leaving for good. And I remember they said, why? So I explained to them exactly how I explained to you. It's crisis of conscience. I mean, I just can't. You know, for the life of me, being part of an organization that will start or embark on a conflict that will see hundreds of thousands dead in many countries all over the world. I've seen it even then. So they said, just give us a few moments. So they went out, they switched on, you know, the lights from their end, and they went out and, you know, they took their time and then they came back. And then when they were coming back, they were coming to shake my hand and to actually give me hugs. However, we think it is better if you are embraced and protected by a bigger agency that belongs to a more influential country than us. So we do have a list of suggestions here for you. The French already are happy with the information that you provided. They are willing to take you. There is also the Americans, and they are happy to take you, as well as the British. What will you do? And so I was thinking, okay, how long do I have to decide? They said 30 minutes.
Okay.
And I said, wow, how generous. Okay, so, give me time. And so I went, to another office. They gave me that office, to have this solitude. I prayed. I asked God for guidance. Please, it was your will that I leave. And now it is your will that I have to choose either of these three. And I thought, French, no, forget it. I don't like the language at all. I thought about the US, but I just survived a cruise missile attack by them. And I was thinking, sure, it's just too early, in the day to extend the hand of friendship. And so I thought, the British, however, my grandfather fought for the British in Iraq. He was an officer, in the British Army in Iraq. And my father worked for the Foreign Office in the past. And I was thinking, goodness, this definitely runs in the DNA somehow. So I thought, okay, the British, so what? I thought, if it was God's will that I go there, it is. I went back to my hosts and I told them that I think I would rather go with the UK. So they said, excellent. And then within 10 minutes, they said, your flight is tonight. I said, yeah, but I don't have any paperwork, any visa. No, don't worry. Everything is taken care of. You will be boarded into the plane. Don't worry. And so they put me into the plane. And there in Heathrow, I had two people coming to meet me, one from MI5 and one from MI6. Both are from counterterrorism. And at the time, we are already now into December of 1998. So they thought that, Father Christmas, Santa, it might sometime reside in Afghanistan because you came from Afghanistan and you came bearing gifts.
Information.
And so so I was debriefed there for about 4 hours. It helped that both of them spoke good Arabic.
Oh, wow.
And they were telling me that my arrival is very opportune because both offices, their counterterrorism, functions were still small. I mean, MI5 was still focusing on the IRA. MI6 was focusing on the former Soviet Union and the counter-proliferation of nuclear materials. However, terrorism from the Muslim world was something their functions were still small. And it is expanding, and more people are joining from other departments to beef up this department. And so I was told that you came just at the right time.
Mm.
And
this is a whirlwind, though.
Yeah.
You've left your old life. You've arrived here. They've said, we're not going to arrest you, but you can't stay here. Where do you want to live? Now you're in the UK. And now they're saying to you, and we want you to go back as an undercover spy?
It didn't happen like this. First, there was a debriefing. Mm. So the debriefings, which supposed to last 2 months, lasted more than that, several more months, where I would first establish a good cover story as to why I'm in London, which both the Qataris and the British authorities did very well to actually create that cover story. Then after that, there was a question of, what do I know? Who am I connected to? What is my position within the jihadist organizations in Afghanistan? The routes, the camps, the locations, the maps. They were enjoying the fact that they will bring these big rolled up maps, and I will be pointing at the locations of camps and safe houses and bases and ammunition dumps and all of that. And then the question came in March of 1999. Would you consider going back to Afghanistan for us? We know that we said that within 6-7 months, we will start to normalize your life. You will be able to go into a college and we will make sure that you graduate and all of that. But, there are always gaps in our knowledge that we need to fill. So would you consider going there? And I remember I said without hesitation, oh, yes, I have no problem whatsoever. And they said, we were going to give you a week or two to consider. I said, no, I don't need a week or two to consider because I'm bored. That's what I said. I'm bored here. You know, while London is an amazing city, it's just, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean, was I addicted to thrill or, you know, or something like that? But I actually felt bored.
So all the way through your life, all the things you're talking about is what I get from it is, and what's surprising to me, you seem to have a willingness to put yourself into situations that I would think were terrifying and I would want to avoid at all costs. And we've kind of talked about the martyrdom thing earlier, but it does occur to me that you seem to be lacking a sense of self-preservation. Like, do you think that's true? Do you sense fear like other people do? Or is it that you're excited and you're addicted to excitement?
I think sometimes I feel that my sense of duty overrides all other considerations. And I remember when I was asked to go back to Afghanistan to spy, you know, for the British intelligence services, I felt that it was my sense of duty. And I remember when they asked me this question, they said, like, don't you feel afraid or terrified to go back there? And this time I said, I know there is an element of danger, an element of risk here, but I will be absolute hypocrite if I was willing to sacrifice my life for the wrong side. And then when I'm on the right side, I become a coward.
Mm.
And I'm not a coward.
Mm. So you're sent back to Al-Qaeda, which is where you were, but this time working on the side of the British authorities as a spy. How do you get the information back to the UK?
Well, we were able to create a very good cover story that I was going to entice members of Al-Qaeda, senior members of Al-Qaeda, to work with me on commercial endeavor, you know, which was to export items of high value from Afghanistan and northern Pakistan into Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries.
Mm.
It worked. So that enabled me at least to be, you know, to go into Pakistan, to go into Dubai, to go into Bahrain, you know, and then from there, with the help and the protection of the British, you know, I would give them, you know, the information that they need. So it was excellent because then the senior members of Al-Qaeda, you know, they are benefiting, you know, financially from it. You know, they are using this money for their own personal use, you know, to get married, to have families, to, you know, have nice houses inside Afghanistan and to be independent financially from Al-Qaeda itself. So they don't get just only depend on the meager salaries that Al-Qaeda is paying them. And this way, you know, they trust me with information, at least some of the times, and I will be able to transmit that information back, you know, to
via mobile phone. Is that how you did it, or computer?
Oh no, you know, unfortunately, you know, during that time we were not in the digital age yet.
Right.
You know, remember it was 1999, 2000, 2001. You know, the mobile phones had no cameras. You know, you can barely send a text on an Ericsson or a Motorola. I mean, you know, I feel old now. We're just mentioning these, you know, devices. And, you know, so, and computers, like, you know, cannot be trusted. And I can't carry a camera with me. A camera is a death sentence.
Right.
You know, so therefore, I have to rely purely on my mind. You know, just memorizing everything around me, you know, looking at the locations, you know, finding geographical features where I can pinpoint on maps. And then when I finally meet them, I will transmit that information. One of the most important, you know, aspects of my training before I was sent back was never ask questions.
Wow.
Never ask questions. Let the information come to you, but do not seek information.
Suspicious.
Yeah, because otherwise you will raise suspicion. And at the same time, just do not show any interest in anything that doesn't concern you. Yes, it's a trade-off. You know, and this is one of the reasons why, for example, I get always asked this question. You know, you were a spy inside Al-Qaeda in the months and the years before 9/11. Mm. How could you not have seen it coming? And I would say, well, we've seen it coming, that something big is going to happen. But the details were so well guarded because the Al-Qaeda was split into compartments.
Mm.
The people who were trained for that, you know, mission were trained in a secret camp that was set up for them. And then they themselves, you know, at least 14 of them, 14 out of the 19, did not know that it was a suicide mission. They thought it was only a hijacking.
Wow.
And that's it. Only five.
Even to the point when they were taking part in the mission, they wouldn't have
yes,
known.
Yes, absolutely. They didn't know.
Jesus Christ.
They didn't know they were actually crashing into buildings. Only five. You know, four pilots and one of the leaders of the hijackers. And the executive council of Al-Qaeda, 20 of them, there are 20, including Bin Laden and his deputy Abu Hafs. So there are 20, only 8, until the last 48 hours, only 8 knew, including Bin Laden and his deputy, about 9/11 and the details. And 12 members of the executive council did not know. And even when they were informed, they were not informed about the exact details 48 hours before it happened. So even if I was an a member of the executive council, which means that I will be 40 years age by then, I should be 40 year old at that time, they would have been told only very few details. Wow. And only 48 hours before the operation.
So you said that there was an awareness that something big was happening.
Yeah.
It was just it wasn't clear what that was going to be.
Exactly.
So would you, in your role, would you have been feeding back the information when you could that there's something being planned, we're not clear when exactly, but...
Yes, because I was tasked with a certain mission, although it was absolutely in the periphery. It is to inform 4 people, you know, here in the UK to leave the UK as soon as possible and to go to Afghanistan before the end of August. That's it. Mm. That was my part in it. If they told me, we need you to transfer money to someone in America, then the entire plot would have unraveled. But unfortunately, you know, that task would have been given to someone else. Mm. It all depends on the right time at the right place. Mm. You see, in order to have foiled 9/11, you needed 20 spies, not just only one, inside Al-Qaeda.
Was there a suspicion of spies within Al-Qaeda? Like,
always.
Always. Even before you'd been one, were you aware that there was a constant suspicion of spies?
Absolutely, always. And there were always random checks here and there. And especially, like, I myself started to attract attention more and more because I am traveling, you know, all the time. And this is why when people come and confront me about my constant travels, I say, oh, go to... Commander A, Commander B, Commander C, whoever, like they're, I'm doing all of this for them. Ah, okay, no problem. So you see the cover story about commercial work and commercial exports, like really helped. Otherwise, I could have been in deep trouble. Or I will be there in Afghanistan in that black hole of information for months and months, unable to transmit anything.
Mm. Were there any times when you were almost exposed or when you felt that you were very much in danger or could have been killed for being found out as a spy?
No.
Never?
Never. I mean, there was, of course, one random check on me, where I was in the kitchen one day, because... And funny enough, it was a kitchen, because a kitchen is where you are feeling, you know, safe and secure and you don't expect any nasty surprises, because all of us have to do either cooking duties, cleaning duties, everyone. From the top commander to the, foot soldier, we all have to do our duties. And so I was in the kitchen and then, I noticed that people are leaving the kitchen, and I was alone. And then, someone behind me, putting a pistol to the back of my, to my back, to my spine. Like, I felt really the cold end of the pistol there. I mean, because it was November, it was really cold. And then I turned around and I saw that it's one of my friends in the camp. And I was, looking at him angry. I was saying, lower your weapon right now. Because he was telling me before that, I know who you are. I know who you're working for. It's over. The game is over. It's done. We know who you work for. Now, thank God. Thank God for the British training, because they alerted me to this before. They told me that when someone comes to you and say, we know who you work for, game over, that's it, it's over. You have to confess. Then they are bluffing because they don't know who you work for. Mm-hmm. It could be anyone. It could be the Saudis, it could be the Bahrainis, it could be the Egyptians, it could be the Jordanians, it could be the Russians, it could be the Americans, the Israelis, whoever. So, if they have no idea who you work for, it means they have no evidence against you. Mm-hmm. So stand your ground immediately, and do not volunteer any information. So this is why when he put the pistol at the back of my, at my back and told me that, those words and trying to be menacing, I know who you work for. If he said the British, yeah, game is over. But he didn't say. He said, I know who you work for. We know you're a spy. That's it. Game over. So I just looked back at him and I was expressing my anger that this is a sick joke and I'm not going to tolerate it. I was thinking it was a joke. When he was taken aback by the level of anger I was having at him and telling him to lower his weapon and I'm not going to tolerate this and I will report it to the camp commander. He was telling me, actually, the camp commander asked me to check on you and others, actually, because you are part
just a
of
random
what we call the travelers, you know, those who travel a lot, like, you know, they need to be shaken down between now and then. I'm sorry, brother, it's nothing personal. I was just told to do it. It was my duty. You know, no, it's okay, it's fine. Like, you know, I don't even doubt you. You know, so, but it's a random check. So it had to be done.
I mean, what I'd like to get onto now is you've been back in there. You've been a spy for how long? How long were you a spy for?
I spent 7.5 years.
7.5? Yeah. My God, I didn't realise it was that long, actually. So 7.5 years as a spy. And then what happened that exposed you as a spy and meant you had to stop?
Well, I mean, I was having the first holiday in my life as a normal human being. I mean, I remember it was June of 2006. And I've already had many tours in Afghanistan, in the Gulf, in Lebanon, in Australia, in Europe. Like, and I mean, so by that time I was, you know, and here in the UK, I was already weary. And I said, like, and I mean, I've never been on a normal holiday like a normal human being. You know, is it possible to go to Paris? I've never been there. And my handler said, yeah, of course, for God's sake, yes, please do. Sorry, we neglected that aspect, you know, so yeah, you can. So I was in Paris, and then out of nowhere, while I was on the riverboat, you know, having a look at the city, I received a text message, you know, from an associate of mine within Al-Qaeda in the Gulf in Bahrain. And he was telling me, you know, brother, there is a spy among us. Go into hiding. Read the Time magazine article. Talking about the book is about to come. Go and read it. And so I was thinking, that's worrying. But then, you know, I'm in the middle of a boat. I can't just jump into the river. I mean, I waited until, you know, we arrived at docking. It left the boat. It was Hotel de Ville. I was going to find an internet cafe. Yes, for the millennials who are watching this, internet cafes are something that existed, you know, in the past in order to go and find information. So I went to an internet cafe. I, you know, switched on the, you know, the Internet Explorer, I remember at that time. You remember the E symbol and all of that. Went into the Time magazine website. And the first thing there, it is an article advertising for a book that is about to come in a week time. And this article says, the U.S. had a brilliant spy inside Al-Qaeda. And I was thinking, ah, it's okay. Like, you know, they're talking about a U.S. spy, not a British one. And then I started reading. And the more I read, the more I felt that, you know, my heart was sinking all the way down to my stomach. Because it really talked about me, about operations that I was involved in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You know, whether it is a chemical attack plans in New York subway, you know, a massive attack that was planned against the U.S. sailors of the 5th Fleet in Bahrain, you know, and the outing of an important Al-Qaeda leader in Saudi Arabia, and which led to his death. You know, so all of these were part of operations that I was the common denominator, you know, among them. And so, and then they decided to give me my real name, even, you know, my first real name, the birth name I had.
In the article,
because he said, let's find a name for him. Let's call him Ali, you know. And so I was thinking, out of 4,000 bloody names in Arabic, couldn't you find any other name except Ali? And then you identify me as having a Bahraini heritage. I mean, you might as well put a crosshair on me, you know. And so
how did this happen?
It was a leak, you know, from the office of the Vice President of the United States, you know, to this journalist, you know, in the U.S., Ron Suskind, who wrote a book called The 1% Doctrine. 46 pages of that book were talking about me and the operations I was involved in terms of intelligence gathering on behalf of the British services. But, you know, they had the audacity to claim that it was American operations, while in fact I was working for the British. Talk about being a vassal state here, yeah? So, you know, so I read all of this. So I went to the nearest, you know, phone booth. Again, for the millennials, you know, these are boxes where phones used to be there. You put coins and you... So I called, you know, the emergency line. It was Sunday. So I called the emergency line, you know, to MI6, you know, and I said, you know, please get, you know, my handler, his name is such so-and-so, you know, to call me on my mobile phone as soon as possible. It's an emergency. I'm in Paris. 5 minutes later, he was on the phone and I said to him, go and read the Time magazine website. Please come back to me and tell me what to do. You know, give me instructions. He came back to me, you know, and he was using lots of F words about the situation. And he was saying, don't worry, just, you know, come back to Waterloo. At that time, it was the Waterloo station, you know, when we come back from Gare du Nord in Paris. So come back to Waterloo. We'll be waiting for you. And we are already sending a car now to your apartment in order to clear it, clean it, take everything, you know, so you will not go back there. We will take you somewhere else in England. And I arrived back, you know, so both my handlers from MI5 and MI6 were waiting for me. They gave me hugs and assurances, you know, don't worry, this isn't the end. We will take care of you. You know, we don't know how this has happened. I mean, already phones are ringing into, you know, DC, trying to understand what really happened here. It's a major leak here. So they took me to Oxford, you know, into the Randolph Hotel just next to the Ashmolean Museum there. I spent several days there, you know, while, you know, people were coming to Oxford every day to, you know, from both organizations to assure me. While assuring me that they will deal with it, they're also telling me that my spying days are over, you know, so.
And I guess at that moment you were out.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I'm exposed. The question is, you know, now what to do? And then it was decided in the end that there was a senior member of the organization of MI6 is leaving, is retiring, and he is going to take up a senior post in one of the global banks. And he said, I want him to come with me. He will be good on counterterrorism finance. He understands the aspects of the terrorism finance and the workings of their banking and charities and hawala systems and the money men and the exchanges. He knows. So I need him with me. So, and that's how it was decided. I'm exchanging one form of terrorism to another. Being a banker is, you know, I think it's in the same moral equivalence of being a bomb maker, I think.
Oh, my God. Well, I'll leave the audience to draw their own decisions on that. Right, Eamon, the problem with talking to you is you're so fascinating. You've just got so many interesting stories that we've gone over. And there's three questions I want to ask you. So the first question, do you still look over your shoulder?
The answer is yes and no. In a sense that, yes, I have to be careful, but also no, because the security measures taken in order to safeguard myself and my family, you know, are so extensive, you know, that more or less I feel much more secure than I used to be, for example, 3-4 years ago.
A lot of the stuff that happened in your life was inspired initially by religion, for good and for bad. Are you still religious?
Yes. I mean, everything that I've seen in my life, yeah, you have to be religious. But in what sense? Ritualistic? No. Spiritualistic? Yes.
Talking to you is so interesting because I've met people before who've been undercover. I've met people who've served in the military in different positions. And all of them seem to have had quite a sort of heavy load put onto their conscience and their soul. There's kind of an element to you that I find just fascinating in the sense that you seem able to process and deal with very severe situations in a way that it doesn't seem to me to have left an emotional toll on you. And maybe it's because you've been, you know, trained in interviews, trained in how to speak, and you're good at hiding that or passing it away. But how do you feel as a person, all the things you've gone through, the aspects of fear, seeing people killed, being responsible for deaths, do things like that stay with you, or are you able to just kind of pass them on?
They stay with you, but you know how to process them. Why? Because do you remember at the beginning I told you about the divine plan? Mm. It's all part of a divine plan. Mm. And that's why I have no regrets. And whatever happened to other people is all part of a divine plan. It's not my part to question it. Mm. It's just you go with the flow. You go with the flow.
Brilliant. And the final question before we finish, what's next for you?
Well, I mean, what's next for me? I mean, I've been living, you know, in the UK on and off for almost 24 years now. And, you know, like, you know, when they say that when you fight for people, you become part of them. Mm. Somehow, this concept been challenged so much over the past year because, you know, over the past year, I started question whether I belong here, whether I belong in the, you know, in the UK or not, whether I belong in Europe, if even to begin with. And I think this is all due to the fact that it's different when you are a single person with no family. But then when you have a family and you have kids and these kids are going into schools, you know, how then, you know, their sense of belonging will be developing. I remember I insisted that, you know, I want my children to grow up here because that's the only citizenship they have. That's the only nationality they have, you know, as UK citizens. But then the events of the past year, you know, made me question whether actually we as a family, whether my kids, you know, belong here. Because my daughter goes to a school in Edinburgh, and, you know, for girls. And that school, along with parents who were there, you know, did not look kindly on the role I played in ensuring the security of this country for, you know, 7.5 and 8 years that I worked for the UK intelligence services. And then the 12 years I worked in the banking sector, you know, identifying, tracking and disrupting terrorism finance. They looked at it as if you are a risk. You know, you shouldn't be, you know, here. Your daughter shouldn't be in school with us and with our daughters. And so they did their best, you know, over a year to try to really, like, you know, I mean, make us feel unwelcome, to the point where they said, that's the head teacher of that school telling, you know, me, don't expect a welcome in Scotland.
God.
And they are telling us, like, you know, why don't you consider leaving the country for the well-being of your kids, because you will never be accepted here. So I thought, you know what, let's pack and leave. Because the question of whether we belong or not has been settled, in my opinion.
I'm sad to hear that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And where have you decided on?
Arabia.
Going back?
Yes.
Well, look, Eamon, it's the second time we've met you. It's just as fascinating to hear the stories.
Thank you.
The second time as the first. And thank you so much for your time and coming in again. Wish you and your family the best of luck with the new adventures. And
thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Take care of yourself.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
So that was Eamon Dean, who was an ex-Al-Qaeda terrorist, turned MI5, MI6 spy. I'm joined now by the director of the episode, Josh. I mean, that was a big episode.
What a man. What an incredible life.
Yeah.
I think we could have done a whole series just on his stages of his of his life. What was your biggest takeaway from where he's at now?
Well, I find him such an incredible character, because we've talked to other people who've done, I mean, not all those things. I mean, even at the end, he talked about how he went into banking, which is a whole career for some people. But it's the coolness, the calm collectedness. You know, the other people that we talk to that have done similar things quite often have long-lasting mental impact. Yes, you feel it on them. That's a nice way to describe it. Whereas with Eamon, you know, I kind of came back to him a couple of times through the discussion and just sort of said, you just don't seem to have an impact.
Yeah. I think that's obviously what served him so well, that ability to just mould into the next thing. And we were talking about, like, he's just completely switched on the drop of a coin from sides and has done that throughout. And I think that is quite a rare thing to be able to do so well. And then to put yourself in the risk that he did, turning as a spy on your own completely, but doing the same life, you need that ability just to focus in on why you're there, I think.
There was, you know, because he comes across as such an unassuming,
gentle, yeah,
friendly man. And there was a comment from the first video we did with him on YouTube that I always remember reading, which was, did you need a reinforced chair for this episode due to the size of this guy's balls? And it's sort of a bit of a throwaway, callous comment, but I genuinely just, even again, speaking to him then, I was just thinking, I couldn't do what he did. No. Either side, you know.
Yeah.
What did you think, Bryony?
What struck me was his really calm energy, despite everything that he has been through and what he was describing, which is experiences that none of us can even possibly imagine. And he said it with such clarity and calmness that he must have something really deep inside him that allows him to have that kind of assurance.
Maybe religion, maybe the religious thing.
Yeah, I was thinking that, but then at 16 to go and choose to do that. I almost felt like by the end of it, I thought religion would be a big part of it, but how quickly he dropped his sort of deep-held, you know, extremist beliefs when he switched, or to be fair to him, when he saw what the results of his actions and Al-Qaeda's were. So and the other bit was when he was in London and he didn't become a spy straight away and get sent back. He just basically said, I was bored in London. So I think that 16-year-old self and the going back a spy, I think he sought out that adventure. And I think that was probably a more powerful personality trait in defining his life than religion.
There was a bit where he was talking about everything he'd gone through and he'd come out of it and he decided to renounce everything. And then he was back and they picked him up from his friends and were saying, don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. And we're going to actually figure it out. And then I said, how old are you at this point? He said, 1920. Yeah. It's just like, my God.
And again, yeah, it's not on him. He's not carrying this stuff. He feels quite just like a normal bank clerk when he walks in.
What did you both take away from it?
I guess what I took from it is just be careful how sure you are that you're right. At the moment in the world, everything's getting increasingly polarised. Even in the UK politics, you know, it doesn't feel like anymore it's kind of a big discussion about what's the best way to help this country. It feels more like if I'm this side, it means I hate your side. And it was interesting to me when he was talking about, you know, it's a cliche, which he said, but he said the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And he said, without wisdom, it's not enough. Well, it's a very interesting point from someone who's fought on two opposing sides of a war.
Yeah, and it's like the biggest international issue of our generation, what he's been at the forefront of. And, you know, I do kind of go, his remorse of being at Al-Qaeda, being a bomb maker, and then, oh, it's all different now, he saw what a bomb could do. And I kind of went into that a bit prejudiced, if you like. Like, I was like, to you, let's probably quiz that a little bit, because if you're making bombs, they're going to use something. But then he was like, that we were against America, I thought we were going to go for military targets, and that's what my work was. And if they're the evil enemy, which is what Al-Qaeda, that is the philosophy. So it kind of, he did have an answer for that a bit. And then when he saw in the East Africa attacks that, you know, hundreds of civilians were collateral damage and he couldn't live with that, I believed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's very brave to go, these are what I've dedicated my life to, but I'm gonna leave. And then to then fight them in such a risky and covert ways, it is admirable. And the amount of impact he's had positively in protecting people from being an undercover spy, it's probably impossible to fully gauge.